Good afternoon. The time is 1:32, and I'd like to call this meeting of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order. We are in Belt's Room 105 of the Thomas Stewart Building in the nation's most beautiful capital city of Juneau, Alaska. Today is Monday, March 4th, 2024. Members present today are Senator Merrick, Senator Ray Jackson, Senator Bishop, and Senator Dunbar, along with myself, Senator Bjorkman. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn off or silence your cell phones. I would like to recognize and welcome our recording secretary, Lisa Denny, as well as our LIO moderator, Joseph Giesbrecht. Today we have three items on our agenda. First up is Senate Bill 154, Better Preference for Military Career Skills Programs, Senate Bill 102, Refuse Utility Regulations, and finally today is Senate Bill 257. Electric utility regulation. As a reminder, Senate Bill 44 was removed from our agenda last week. Welcome everyone to Senate Labor and Commerce. First up, Senate Bill 154 we have with us today. Bill sponsors Senator Bill Welikowski and his staff Caleb Callahan to give a summary of the bill and answer any questions that the committee may have. Senator, welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Welikowski. I'm a state senator representing East Anchorage, and with me is Caleb Callahan, who is a UAA intern in my office. Mr. Chairman, I'll be very brief. This bill seeks to establish a bidder preference for state contracts for veterans and service members. And the way it does that is to encourage businesses to hire service members who are going through apprentice-type programs. And just some statistics on veterans, particularly after they transition out of the military, the statistics are pretty startling. 43% of post-9/11 veterans could not find a job within 6 months after leaving the military and starting their job search. The labor force participation for veterans is around 47.7% versus 64% for non-veterans. The unemployment rate for spouses of active duty service members is has been about 21% historically. Some of the barriers for employment that have been identified, there was a study published in the University of Southern California Center for Innovation and Research in Veterans and Military Families, found the most prominent barriers, among the most prominent barriers to employment for veterans are lack of transition support or negative experience with support services, feeling of entirely starting over, perceived employer and societal stigma and discrimination. And so what this bill seeks to do is to establish a bidder preference for companies that hire employees that are go through these programs that are designed to help service members get jobs after they leave the military. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll stop right there. And if there are no questions, I could have Caleb go through very quickly some of the aspects of the bill.
Are there any questions for Senator Welikowski? Seeing and hearing none, Mr. Callahan, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for the record, my name is Caleb Callahan. I'm an intern for Senator Welikowski. And just to reiterate that we are trying to close the transition gap between military service members who are finished with their long military contracts and are transitioning into the civilian workforce program. I like to think of this bill as a supporting pipeline for exiting service members so that service members can get employed and businesses also get bonuses on bids for it. These programs that we're talking about specifically are DoD Skill Bridge and Army Career Service programs. These are programs that are within the 180 days of service members' contract expiring. They offer apprenticeships, internships, training programs to transition them directly into a career field that they'd like to see. And these are programs that are already exist and established within Alaska. Army Career Services have locations in Fort Wainwright and in Fort Richardson. SkillBridge, for example, also has at least 30 partners in Anchorage and about 8 partners in Fairbanks, and they are all over the state. DoD SkillBridge allows service members to receive their salary and their benefits while training for new careers from the past 180 days of their military contracts. So this bill targets those members looking to transfer out of the military into the civilian workforce. These programs are already established, and they're supporting all types of professions around Alaska that our highly skilled service members can provide. Some examples that I could give would be in the medical industry, small business, snow plowing, and Ford, so that Black Hawk mechanics can get lined up for work at a Ford factory or in auto repair shops, so that combat medics can get medical or nursing jobs, and that Army construction officers can get certifications to be heavy equipment operators or snowplowers. Again, this bill establishes a 2% bidder preference, but it's capped at $5,000. So if there was $1 million contract bid, we wouldn't be giving them $20,000. It's capped at $5,000. So this is a cheap way for this is a modest expenditure for win-win scenarios in Alaska. And eligible entities are those that have employed at least one person enrolled in or recently graduated from the United States Department of Defense, SkillBridge, or Army Career Servicemen, or services for service members or spouses. Thank you so much, Committee of Labor and Commerce. I'd be happy to take any questions for you guys.
Mr. Callahan, well done. Thank you. Questions from committee members? Senator Bishop.
Yeah, I'm just thinking. I haven't really dove into this bill here a little bit, but how is this different than helmets to hard hats, or is this just an H2H program that the military has had, and I think it's still currently in play? Is this just supplement the helmets to hard hats program, and does this bill, obviously, taking these individuals that's in this SkillBridge program, and if a contractor takes and hires one of these SkillBridge veterans, they can have a $5,000. You give the analogy of a $1 million job, but they'd still only get a $5,000. Preference, not to exceed $5,000. So the bid could be $1,005,000, and they could be considered low bidder. Is this how this would work?
Callahan, through the chair, to Senator Bishop, Vice Chair. Yes, that last point you made is correct. It is at a cap of $5,000. It's important to note that a lot of these contracts won't be $1 million contracts. A lot of them will, I presume, would be a lot less than $1 million. But it's the intent here is to get businesses to allow businesses to recognize that they can get these bidder preferences to encourage them to utilize these programs. You mentioned helmets to hard hats. I am personally not too aware of that program, but from what you've briefly described, it kind of does sound like it's really similar to DoD SkillBridge, to where you're taking active service members who are finishing their contracts and offering them skills that are easily transitionable into the workforce. I hope I was able to answer your question, Senator Bishop.
You did.
Oh, yeah. Good. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, just a follow-up.
Senator Rilke.
So what this does, in contrast to helmets to hard hats, this provides a bidder preference to companies. Mm-hmm. So if a company wants to go ahead, if a company has hired someone who is employed by U.S. DoD SkillBridge or Army Career Skills Program, then that company would be the one that would get the bidder preference when they're going to hire.
Right.
And so if they were to bid $100,000 on a project, then they would get a 2%, it would reduce their bid, I guess, by 2%. So if somebody else bid $99,000, the company that bid $100,000 would get it because they'd get that 2% preference.
The whole goal is to get more skilled people in the workforce. Am I correct?
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
I'm done. Thank you.
Mr. Callahan.
If I could follow up on a comment as well. Back to my idea of this is like a good pipeline bill. There already is statute for veteran preference, but they don't mention these transitionary bidder preferences. So this bill gives a 2% preference for service members to become veterans. Ideally, they would eventually get enough service members that are then veterans to then be able to qualify for the 5% bidder preference that is already in statute to be a qualifying entity for that.
Excellent. I just have one question.
Please, yeah.
So a company just has to track how many people that they employ that are within 2 years graduated from a company like SkillBridge. They track that. They submit that evidence to whomever they are bidding as a part of their bid packet, and then they're eligible for the preference?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This is Callahan. I would also like to add that there wouldn't even need to be that much tracking because to become a qualifying entity for this bidder preference, you only need one member that is either enrolled in or a part of the Skillshare program. If your business is already a partner with SkillBridge, you have already offered what you can take in and apprenticeships that can be offered through DoD to your SkillBridge program. So just the fact that you had one would mean that you're already a partner, and that's what we're going for. Perfect. So you would get the better preference.
Thank you. Seeing nothing further, this time I will open public testimony on Senate Bill 154. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify to Senate Bill 154? Is there anyone online? Kyle Kaser. Mr. Kaser, please state your name and location for the record and begin your testimony. You have 2 minutes.
My name is Kyle Kaiser. I'm the president and founder of Viper Transitions, DoD SkillBridge program here in Alaska. I'm in full support of this bill because part of the problem service members transitioning out, military spouses and veterans have is access to the job site. We hear a lot of talk about workforce development and how do we retain military personnel and families and just really anybody in Alaska from pursuing careers outside of the state. Being involved in the transition space, I can tell you that around 80% of the service members getting out of the military in Alaska leave. We want that to change. We want them to stay here, and the best way to do that is providing an opportunity. If we wait until they're already separated, to be honest, it's too late. They're already figuring out what they're going to do, where they're going to go, how they're going to pay for life. We need to be able to do this in that SkillBridge window, that 180 days prior, the year prior, identify where they're going to go, how much money they're going to make, what their benefits are going to look like, the job that they're going to have, the career path they're going to follow. So when that 180-day window hits, they can get slotted into these pre-apprenticeship programs and these skill-building programs so that they can get out and start and join the workforce without a lag. It's a great plan for the service member. I think it'll do great things for our state. And I really, really like the way this bill is written as far as incentivizing employers to help out. Because at the end of the day, it's good for them and finding their next generation of workforce and where it's going to come from. It really helps the military build on its presence here in Alaska, and I think it would be a great thing for everybody involved. And I heard reference to helmets to hard hats. There's a lot of great programs out there that recruit and inform separating service members, veterans, and mill spouses on what jobs are available. The issue isn't contacting folks. The issue is placing folks. And what this bill does is actually create a landing spot or incentivize employers to create a landing spot for those service members. We can tell them all day long how great an apprenticeship is, but if nobody has a position to hire them as an apprentice, it doesn't do any good. So this bill changes some of that in incentivizing employers to actually have that spot for them established. So again, that's why I'm in full support of this bill. Thank you, everybody, for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kayser. Anyone else wishing to testify to Senate Bill 154? Seeing and hearing no one else wishing to testify, I will hold public testimony open on Senate Bill 154. Is there further committee discussion? Senator Bishop.
Senator Merrick and I had a hearing last Friday, I believe, on Friday morning on broadband conversation from the Department of Community and Economic Development, and talking about the broadband build-out in the state. And I asked the director, what's your workforce needs? He said 17,000 people. I'll just leave the committee with that number.
Thank you, Senator. Anything further? Seeing none, we'll set this bill aside. We'll take a brief at ease while we set up for our next bill. Back on the record. Up next is Senate Bill 102, brought to us by the Honorable Senator Rob Myers. We're talking about refuse utility regulations. Senator Myers has his staff, Dawson Mann, with him today to discuss the bill. Senator, please put your name on the record and begin your presentation on this legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Robert Myers, District Q up in the Fairbanks area. And as you mentioned, I brought my chief of staff with me, Dawson Mann. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, appreciate you hearing the bill today. We're going to be presenting SB 102, having to do with refuse utility regulations with the RCA. Before Mr. Mann provides a short sectional analysis of the bill, I do want to speak to the sponsor statement. SB 102 is based off of language that passed this body unanimously 2 years ago in another larger bill. SB 102 is designed to streamline the rate adjustment process for refuse utilities by allowing them to make use of the already existing simplified rate filing procedure. This procedure allows utilities to apply for rate adjustments over a specified period, provided they meet certain regulatory requirements. The RCA will be required to adopt specific regulations tailored to the unique nature of refuse utilities. These regulations will include provisions for sufficient public notice and meaningful opportunities for rate payers to comment on rate filings. I will note that one change from older versions of this language is that we made the wording regarding the public process statute and not just intent language as it had been in a previous version of the bill. By doing so, the bill promotes transparency and accountability in the rate setting process, safeguarding the interests of both consumers and utility providers. SB 102 establishes a balanced approach to regulating refuse utility rates in Alaska, prioritizing fairness, transparency, public participation, and expediency. And with that, Mr. Chair, if you'd like, Mr. Mann can go over the sectional analysis for the bill.
I would indeed. Thank you, Senator Myers.
Thank you. For the record, Dawson Mann, staff to Senator Myers. Good afternoon, Chair Bjorkman, Vice Chair Bishop, members of the committee. I would touch briefly on the sectional analysis for SB 102. Section 1, lines 4 through 14, page 2, lines 1 through 4. Amends the section of statute regarding the simplified rate filing procedure to include refuse utilities. This section also outlines that the RCA shall adopt regulations specific to refuse utilities to provide sufficient public notice in time for ratepayers to meaningfully comment on the rate filings. And as Senator Myers mentioned, this was previously intent language. After conversations with the drafter, we chose to make this firm statute. And then Section 2, page 2, line 5, establishes an immediate effective date.
Excellent. Are there questions from members of the committee? Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just so I understand this correctly, the intent here is to simplify this process but not change who this process applies to, correct? So there are would there be, after we pass this, would it change any of the – because there are some waste companies that aren't regulated by the RCA. Would this change that in any way?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, we're not changing who is regulated. We are taking an existing regulatory process and applying it to waste companies. But we're not creating that new process, nor are we changing which waste companies are regulated and which ones are not.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
So there are sort of collections, utilities, and then there are there's the utility that runs the Anchorage landfill, for example, that portion of SWS. I see one letter of support here from Alaska Waste. Have you heard anything from the from SWS? They kind of have both sides of it, right? They have the collections utility and they have the landfill. Have they expressed any views on this bill?
For the record, Dawson Mann, we have, I believe, two representatives from the RCA online who could speak to the relationship between the RCA and the municipal trash collection.
Okay.
Very good. We do have online chair of the RCA, Robert Boyle, and advisory section manager for the Regulatory Commission, Becky Alvey. If either of you two would like to answer Senator Dunbar's question, that would be most excellent.
Hi, this is Robert Doyle, the chair for the RCA, through the chair. In terms of the specific landfill operation, we don't regulate the specific landfill. We regulate the refuse utilities. And this is a pretty straightforward, simple process. Electrical cooperatives and the local exchange telephone utilities have been doing it for a number of years. It basically is going to avoid cost. It's going to start, it'll save and reduce time-consuming processes and come up with some moderate adjustments. There are controls to the maximum. They are quarterly filing. For electrical utilities, the maximum they can increase is 8% in 12 months or 20% in 36 months. For the telecoms, it would be 6% over 12 months and 15% in 36 months. So there are some of those limitations to keep the size of the increase down, and that's really an outcome of the regulatory docket where we open it up for public comment and we'll go through a lot of the questions and get the public due process through that way. So that's kind of it in a nutshell, but we don't regulate the landfills themselves, just the refuse collection utilities.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so SWS might be a little bit unique then, that it's both a collection and collection utility and a utility, I'm sorry, a landfill. How would SWS be impacted by this legislation, if at all? Would the trash collection portion of their business be impacted by this?
Yeah, this is Robert Doyle, RCA chair, again, through the chair. Yes, the trash collection portion, they could apply for it as a regulated entity. The SRF filings, just as anybody else would do, and there would be non-regulated small ones that may not do that. But anybody that's regulated, it would be just for the refuse collection utilities themselves.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for bringing this bill forward. So just for clarity, what this bill is doing is adding refuse utilities to the list of cooperatives or utilities that are regulated by the RCA. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Gray Jackson. The refuse utilities are already regulated by the RCA. what we're doing is saying that they are allowed to be regulated through this simplified rate filing process. So we're not changing who's being regulated. We're just allowing them access to this process that the electric co-ops are already using.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. Further questions? Senator Myers, I have a question for Chair Doyle. Chair Doyle, I have heard some discussion about the phrase local exchange telephone utilities included in this subsection E. Does the RCA regulate local exchange telephone utilities now?
Yes, local exchange carriers are regulated. Some are not, but many are. And for example, up in Kotzebue, I think it's OTZ Cooperative. That's an example of a regulated utility that's regulated right now. And there's LECs, and then there's also interstate carriers. So there's different categories of carriers, whether they're local only or interstate. And then you have intrastate and interstate. And interstate is a federal thing. Intrastate are your LEXs, I think is the correct term.
And is there a desire, Chair Doyle, on the part of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska to make a change surrounding that telephone utility language?
Not to my knowledge. And this legislation that's being proposed is just, I think, a sensible way to try and again, because I was on the Matt Newsfield Electric Board for 12 years. And it's a pretty simple, straightforward process with SRF filings. And as the staff has explained, it just changes the bigger rate process that maybe over multiple years that turns into quite a big expense for both the ratepayers and the utilities. And so by having these SRFs doing it on a quarterly basis, it just makes it less time consuming, less costly, and it comes up with more moderate kind of adjustments. But there's no intent for us to change anything for the LECs at this point.
Very good. Thank you. Any further questions or comments? Seeing and hearing none, at this time I'll open public testimony on Senate Bill 102. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify to Senate Bill 102? Anyone online? We have Kurt Froning. Mr. Froning, please state your name and location for the record. You have 2 minutes.
Good afternoon, Senators. Yes, I'd like to just give my support behind Senate Bill 102. I'm the Division Vice President for Alaska Waste and operations throughout Alaska that are regulated to one degree or another. The simplified rate filing process that we're seeking here will just make it much easier for us to adjust our rates to current market conditions and things that are happening in the local markets. Currently, the statute is a 450-day process currently. So when we turn in we seek rates, the RCA has currently 450 days to make a ruling on those rates. So by the time rates are enacted, the data and the expenses have changed drastically. It also costs an enormous amount of money. For example, our last rate case cost somewhere in the neighborhood of $500,000 for us to prepare, which cost is then passed on to our ratepayers. And we think that this process will make it just much more streamlined and less expensive for us and for our ratepayers as well. And as has been mentioned, there's already a process in place for electric cooperatives and local exchange telephone utilities. We simply want to piggyback on the legislation that's already out there, allowing us to avail ourselves of that simplified rate filing process. Thank you.
Could you just state your name for the record, please?
Yeah, sorry. My name is Kurt Froning.
Mr. Froning, thank you very much for your testimony today. Anyone else online who would like to testify? Seeing and hearing none, at this time I will hold public testimony open on Senate Bill 102. Is there further committee discussion? Senator Myers, thank you for bringing this bill to our attention. I think it's a common sense bill that trash utilities should be able to take advantage of the simplified rate filing process. So thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Appreciate the committee's time. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. We'll take a brief at ease while we set up for the next bill. Back on the record, 205, the Thomas Stewart Building. We're in Belts Room 105. We will now take up a very high-energy piece of legislation, Senate Bill 257, Electric Utility Regulation. We have with us Senator Kathy Geisel to present the bill. Senator Geisel.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Kathy Geisel. I have the honor of representing Senate District E, that's E as in energy. It's in the southern part of the municipality of Anchorage and also includes Whittier. So today I am presenting to you the Senate Resources Committee bill, Senate Bill 257. This bill addresses an urgent need for Alaska, our citizens, and our future. Alaskans need lower energy costs. I guess that's an understatement. The federal government recognizes this need, not only for Alaska, but nationally. And Alaska has received $206.5 million in a grant to be matched by the state to begin the modernization of our small, outdated grid. The urgency is evident. The acquisition of materials for the upgrades will be challenging at this time, and permitting continues to be a long process. Like planting a tree, now is the proper time to do this. Alaskans pay a high price for electric energy. As electrons travel north, they travel through transmission lines that today function like toll roads with charges as the electrons pass through each section, which is owned by different utilities. As Alaska makes transitions to more diverse energy sources, it's imperative that all energy producers have access to this electron highway. These diverse energy sources may come from clean energy sources like wind, solar, small modular reactors, geothermal, tidal, or mitigated coal, as is executed today in North Dakota. Access to a modernized, efficient transmission highway is the cornerstone of building low-cost energy for Alaskans. This bill is the first step in upgrading Alaska's rail belt transmission system, which will allow for increased capacity, accommodating changing and growing energy demands for 70% of our population from Homer to Fairbanks. A modernized system will improve reliability, reduce the risk of outages, and ensure consistent energy supply to communities and industries along the rail belt. A modernized system opens the door for increased economic opportunities and new industries. Upgraded grids enhance electric efficiency, reducing line losses during transmission and distribution processes, and reduce the cost to ratepayers. Senate Bill 257 provides for long-term governance and planning of the grid system and accelerating the energy transition in Alaska. This bill unifies existing transmission assets along the rail belt in order to reduce transmission constraints, remove bottlenecks, improve redundancies while removing wheeling charges, that's those toll road fees we were talking about, and smoothing out cost recovery mechanisms. Upgrading and unifying the transition system allows for more rapid and efficient integration of all new clean electric generation sources. Upgraded transmission systems also can help stimulate economic growth by attracting investment, supporting industrial development, and creating jobs in the energy sector. This bill demonstrates a long-needed investment into the state of Alaska that demonstrates our commitment to long-term energy planning and sustainability, as well as ensuring reliable power supply for generations of Alaskans. Mr. Chairman, that's just a brief overview of the need for this bill. At your pleasure, Mr. Chairman, I would suggest deferring SB 257's sectional analysis to another hearing so that you can hear today from Gwen Holdman from the Alaska Center for Energy and Power at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, Tony Izzo, Matanuska Electric Association, John Burns, Golden Valley Electric Association, and Curtis Thayer, the CEO of Alaska Energy Authority. Mr. Chairman, we had also invited Mr. Chris Rose. He was invited but unable to attend today, Mr. Chairman. He is the chairman of Renewable Energy Alaska Project, otherwise known as REAP. I'm pretty sure he'll be available at the next hearing, Mr. Chairman, but he is not here today. So thank you, Mr. Chairman, for hearing this bill today.
You're welcome, Senator Giesel. I would love to hear from Gwen Holdman. Ms. Holdman, if you could come up, and I believe you have a presentation for us.
Thank you, Chairman Bjorkman. I'm really pleased to be here today in order to be able to present on SB 257 for the record. My name is Gwen Holdman. I represent the University of Alaska Fairbanks. At the University of Alaska Fairbanks, Alaska Center for Energy and Power, we've been doing quite a bit of work looking at energy planning and effective energy market design. I'm really pleased to share some of the results of our analysis as they pertain to the rail belt and as they pertain to the bill that's before you today. I think that Senator Giesel did a fantastic job of laying out a bit of the vision and a bit of the challenges that are facing us today. There is some real urgency around the rail belt situation when it comes to energy today. And we're at a point in time, like really an opportunity to either move this system forward or to some extent have the possibility of slipping backwards. I think that the vision that we have here, allowing the cheapest cost power to get to end users wherever it's produced, whatever that source is, and wherever that generation is located, is something that would be broadly agreed with. Facilitating clean energy projects at scale for energy security and diversification is the second high-level goal and vision for the rail belt system as a whole. And although this says clean energy projects, I think that that could really be replaced with local energy projects. As Senator Giesel mentioned, this is really a technology agnostic piece of legislation that serves to move any kind of energy resource that may be available to us now or in the future to places where our residents can benefit from the lowest cost energy available across the system. The senator also mentioned some of the challenges that we have related to our rail belt. I won't go through all of these, but I will say that one of the challenges that we do have is that we have a number of different utilities that operate along the rail belt system, along with ownership of some of the assets by the state of Alaska through the Alaska Energy Authority. And these local cooperative utilities are inherently local by nature. They're governed by local boards, and there's local politics that are inherently going to be part of the mix. And so sometimes those local politics can get in the way of looking at the system as a whole and the benefit for the system as a whole. Projects are more economic when built at scale. There's no question that building one larger 150 megawatt wind farm, we'll use that as an example, is more economical and produce lower cost power than building three individual 50 megawatt wind farms at different places where the resource may not be as optimal as in that one single location. And so what we really want to be able to do is be able to move power to users wherever it's produced at the lowest cost power and not have the cost of transmission be a barrier to moving that low-cost power from users wherever they're located and from wherever that source is located. We know that we have the challenge around GRIP matching. This is potentially the largest investment in upgrading our transmission network that has been made in several decades. It's a big opportunity in front of us, but there's an opportunity that in addition to really addressing these constraints that we have right now with our system, technical constraints of moving power across the system, that we can also address some of the structural constraints that prevent us from effectively managing the system as a system and not just as local independent utilities. We are behind in Alaska significantly on this issue. And we've been able to be behind in part because we are an islanded grid. We're not connected to Canada or the rest of the country. And that means that we haven't been forced to deregulate our systems or to decouple transmission from other assets on the grid, as has been commonplace in other markets. But the good news there is it allows us to do it in our own way and in the way that makes the most sense for Alaska. And we also have a great deal of opportunity to learn from best practices in other markets, from other markets that most emulate our own market here in Alaska. And so a lot of the research that the Alaska Center for Energy and Power has been doing is looking at some of those markets. And most specifically, the ones that we find are most, that we have the most to learn from, are Iceland, Texas, and Hawaii. And so this piece of legislation incorporates elements of best practices from all three of those jurisdictions. I'm going to skip this slide in the interest of time. There's three really big overarching goals. One that I think is broadly agreed upon is this idea of eliminating pancaking wheeling rates. I'll talk a little bit more about each one of these briefly, so I don't want to spend too much time here. Second one is really about how do we actually organize these assets? You know, how do we actually make sure that we have a streamlined management organizational system around these transmission assets? And this is particularly important as we're looking at investment in new assets. As we have GRIP funding potentially before us, and that will result in the construction of new assets that are likely to be owned by the state of Alaska. And so as those new assets come online, we need a structure for how we hold, own, maintain, and operate those assets as a group to the benefit of everybody. And then part of that is really also about reimagining how we do planning for the maximum benefit of the system as a whole. That doesn't look at just transmission planning or just the planning for around specific generation assets or upgrades to the distribution system, which are going to be needed at some point in time too. But how do we really incorporate and integrate all these different planning aspects and make sure that we're also bringing in all the different stakeholders that are an important part of this process for the benefit of the system and our future?
Senator Mayer, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Chair Bjorkman. Hi, Ms. Holman. Thank you for being here. Do you have any thoughts or recommendations, advice for the committee on if we should pay all of the matching GRIP funds in a lump sum or if we should spread that out over a number of years.
Senator Merrick, through the chair, I'm not prepared to speak specifically to that. I do think what I can say is I think it's incredibly important for us to signal to the federal government that we're quite serious about providing match for these kinds of federal funding. I think that I would like to see Alaska benefit as much as possible from the types of federal funding opportunities that are out there. And if we don't have a clear path and process for supplying match for these, I think that it does put our opportunity to be competitive for these funds at some risk. And that's concerning to me. I do think that the federal funding isn't just related to GRIP. I mean, that's a big one. But as it pertains to the rail belt, a lot of these potential projects that are being proposed, whether it's a wind farm or a geothermal project, at Mount Augustine, they all have the potential to really benefit from federal funding. And we need to demonstrate that Alaska and the businesses that are operating here, the utilities and the state as a whole, are very, very much leaning into developing these sorts of projects in partnership with the federal government.
Great. Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, I'm sure Senator Bishop and I will be digging deeper into this in the Finance Committee.
I have no doubt that you will. Ms. Holden, please continue.
So Senator Giesel already alluded to the fact that that what we're really trying to do is move away from this toll road. I think a toll road is actually a really good analogy here. Please do not take any of these little prices that I put on here very seriously. They're just really meant to kind of illustrate the fact that the challenge that we're up against right now is that when you have, as an example, let's say a wind project that's built up in the Fairbanks area in the Golden Valley service territory, and that might come onto that grid at 8 cents a kilowatt hour, by the time you might get that power all the way down to the other end of the system, you're going to have these accrued costs to it that no longer make it economical for that utility to participate in that project. And we really need to get away from this idea that we are going to minimize participation across multiple different utilities in a project that makes economic sense because of the cost of transmission to get that power to users at other utilities. And again, this is not about renewables. This certainly incentivizes and enables renewables at scale, no question about that. But the same holds true whether you're talking about basically anything that's on Senator Bishop's whiteboard will will benefit from this kind of a system. We're setting up a system and a structure that enables the cheapest power to get from producers to users wherever they're located. So it's not creating sticks, it's not creating carrots per se, it's just creating an open highway to enable the private market to act.
Very good.
So there's still costs for transmission. They don't go away, right? And so the idea here with this particular bill is it puts some thought and effort into how we reallocate those costs in a different mechanism. I'm using a different mechanism than just stacking these pancaking wheeling rates and moving them with the energy as it's produced. And so I won't go into a lot of details on this here, but this does follow what we have viewed as a best practice model from the state of Texas in this particular case. In no case do any of these analogs from other jurisdictions, should they be like lifted wholesale and used in Alaska. There's always going to be the need for adjustment to Alaska size, these sorts of things. But in this case, they have a very simple mechanism for rate recovery associated with transition and transmission. And most importantly, it really allocates it based on these sorts of, when the peak utilization of the system is occurring. Because if you think about a highway, if you just have cars moving back and forth, and you have a million cars on highway, but they're all moving at 24 hours a day, equally spaced, that's fine. It's not about how much energy. It's not about how many cars you're moving across the system. The challenge is rush hour, right? That's where there's going to be more costs incurred. That's when you need to make decisions about, do we build another lane, right? Do we need to upgrade the transmission system? It's about when that congestion occurs. And so that's really more of a best practice about how we recoup the costs associated with transmission because the decisions about investing in new transmission are based on when that peak utilization occurs, peak demand, and not based on the total amount of energy that's moving through the system.
Of course, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your presentation, Ms. Holdman. So one thing, you mentioned Texas, and Texas being an island, as it says there, with their own system. Unfortunately, Texas has become sort of notorious in the last few years for their catastrophic failure that led to freezing deaths and other things because they've been so poorly managed, their energy grid system.
Yep.
So I guess I'm curious, sort of, can you reassure my constituents that this bill won't cause this kind of problems that we've seen in Texas, which might not actually be related to this? I'm not sure. But can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, Senator Dunbar, through the chair, I think that's actually an excellent question, because we certainly did see a lot of challenges associated with Texas's grid, although it wasn't necessarily so much of an issue with the grid as a challenge related to the generation sources and the fact that they weren't really able to operate in the kinds of cold temperatures and under the conditions that were seen there. This I view as a separate issue. That is really about their completely open and competitive market structure. This is one of the reasons why Alaska can never be perfectly analogous to some of these other jurisdictions. Texas is literally two orders of magnitude larger than the rail belt grid when we look at how many kilowatt hours are sold on an annual basis. And so there's a point at which that completely open market starts to break down a little bit when we have a smaller system. And so in that particular case, it was all about the cheapest power, right? Getting the cheapest power on the grid. And sometimes that cheap power didn't come with the resilience and reliability metrics that we would like to see. And that's why something like this, this energy reliability organization, the ERO, the Rail Belt Reliability Council, is also a really important piece of the bigger picture that we have here in Alaska, because we need to make sure that we don't just have cheap power. We need to ensure that we have reliable power to our consumers as well. And so that's actually another piece that this bill brings in, is allowing the RCA to make decisions beyond just lowest cost power to consumers, taking into account things like reliability or load growth or other factors like that that benefit us out into the future and really help us with our long-term objectives around energy supply.
Brief follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Please do.
I could be mistaken, but I think the ERO also has some specific role in the RTO. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Senator Dunbar, through the chair. There is definitely a bit of attempt in this bill to clarify the roles and responsibilities of the two organizations in relation to one another. In most jurisdictions, a reliability organization is not responsible for planning. They're asked to focus specifically on reliability and then enforcement of those reliability standards. Typically, they don't take on planning as an additional component. We don't want to see planning occurring in two different places. And so the choice from the committee was to move the planning functions to the Rail Belt Transmission Organization, this newly formed organization, with the idea that the ERO, the RRC, the Rail Belt Reliability Council in this particular case, would play an important role as a stakeholder in that planning process.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I have a question. With the institution of a transmission organization, what work products and outcomes can we expect from the electric reliability organization? What's their purpose for existence if we have a rail belt transmission operator that is doing the planning? Why do we need an ERO still?
Reliability, Senator Yorkman, is actually still a really important component of a functioning system. And this is exactly what we're talking about when we looked at Texas. This is really where the failure in Texas was. It wasn't around cheap power. They had cheap power. What they were lacking was the adequate reliability standards to make sure that that cheap power also was going to be reliably available to consumers. So I don't have a specific position other than to say that reliability is an important function. And so at this point in time, the way that this legislative body has set this up is that it's to have an electric reliability organization that is that pertains to the grid, and that's been established and set up.
Very well. Please continue.
Okay. So the Rail Belt Transmission Organization, as it has been designed, or that it is designed in this bill, really models what we view as a best practice from the country of Iceland. And so in this case, they also have a similarly small electric grid, and they have a small population, much like us. So in the case of Iceland, they have about 370,000 residents in the entire country. The Rail Belt grid serves something around 500,000. So Rail Belt grid's a little bit bigger when it comes to population, but it's not an order of magnitude different like we're talking about in Texas. And so Iceland really was forced to deregulate its utility industry and unbundle its transmission assets from generation and distribution utilities 3 decades ago. And that was based on EU regulation. So they didn't have a choice. So even though they were an islanded grid and they felt like they were doing just great on their own, they were forced by European Union regulations, which they're part of the European Economic Zone. They're not a full member, but they need to adopt those kinds of regulations. And so they did so a little bit reluctantly. They have since made some modifications to how they actually have designed their transmission organization, LensNet. We have the opportunity to benefit from their learning over 3 decades and how they have tweaked that organization. At the time, there was some kicking and screaming, especially by some of the utilities, about the development of that. But I've spent a lot of time in Iceland, and in the last decade, I have not heard anyone say that this was not a really critical first step to the open market and the very inexpensive power that they have today. In their case, they actually identified specific savings regarding creating this organization, LensNet. I can't promise that that would be the same in Alaska, but they did identify savings of like a penny or two per kilowatt hour as a result of like creating this sort of umbrella organization. In the case of Alaska, we already have some workable models that we can use. You know, I think the last thing that anybody wants is a new organization that's going to create additional significant cost or take 2 to 3 years to work out the details on. And so one of the things is to kind of look at the tools that we already have in the toolkit that are working well and figure out if we can adapt them to this purpose. One is the Bradley Project Management Committee, which was set up to oversee the Bradley Lake Management Project, or the Bradley Lake Project, I apologize. This is an organization that stood the test of time, including significant dispute resolution. And so this is a way that the utilities with the state of Alaska have found a mechanism to work together over several decades successfully and iterating on various issues as they've come up. It's a good place to start. The big challenge here is that this is not a regulated organization. In fact, right now, this organization and the BPMC has been starting to incorporate other assets under its portfolio. And so the idea here with a separate, similar kind of sister organization adapting from what has been done well with the BPMC, using that as a starting point, as a template, we can go ahead and form an organization that serves as this RTO, just like in Iceland, it's within state government for cost-saving reasons, but it would be regulated by the RCA, and that's a fairly significant difference from the Bradley Project, which is exempt from regulation. And so that's one thing that this bill does, is that it does make it subject to RCA regulation.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This might be a question better suited for Director Thayer, but I'd like to hear you weigh on it in on it too. As this organization starts to oversee, manage, develop that transmission, the transmission assets, and you know, hopefully we will get the matching funds for the GRIP upgrades. Those will be assets held by this new organization, right? The RTO. My question is about existing transmission assets held by other rail belt utilities. So, for example, if they are upgraded as part of the overall GRIP funded improvements, is the vision that those assets would be turned over to the RTO? And sort of what's the process by which utilities can be either compensated, or can you just speak a little bit more about that process? So utilities will agree to do it, basically.
Thank you, Senator Dunbar, through the chair. The way that this bill lays this out is that there's not any reason why existing assets need to be sold. Now, the ones that are currently owned by the state, I would envision as being rolled into this organization. That includes the Alaska Intertie and now the SQ line on the Kenai Peninsula. But with that being said, the assets that are owned by the utilities could be sold. They can be leased. There are whatever mechanism the utility wants to work out. And this is the way it worked in Iceland. And the reason is that a lot of times those assets are actually rolled up in long-term debt that the utilities hold. And so the idea of like separating those assets and selling them can really create challenges for the utility. So it's really up to each individual utility to decide how they want to interact with the RTO in terms of the ownership management of the assets that they hold today.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I have a question.
Yes.
Who decides, and along with who, what process would be used by an entity, whether it's the RTO or whomever gets to call balls and strikes on what is transmission? Who gets to decide what the difference is between transmission and delivery? Who gets to make that call about, okay, we're using these lines to transmit electrons from Homer to Healy, and we're using these lines for distribution? Who gets to decide that?
Thank you, Senator Bjorkman. So there are actually very specific rules that are pretty well accepted by the industry that differentiate backbone transmission assets, which is really what we're talking about here, from radial assets, and then also separately from like distribution assets. And so the idea here in this bill in particular leaves it to the regulatory commission to actually define what constitutes the rail belt backbone grid.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll just touch on who's calling balls and strikes to his analogy. One would think common sense, if you're deciding who's calling balls and strikes, maybe there's a kilowatt number that's going to define transmission and a kilowatt number that would define distribution.
Yes.
That's just me talking.
Yes, Senator Bishop, through the chair, that's absolutely true. and I think that the primary issue there is really when it comes to radial transmission lines that are within a specific that serve a specific utility or a portion of their service territory. That's not really part of this backbone that we're wheeling power. So that's really the biggest place where we need to distinguish what that highway is and what's a side road, even if it's at the same, you know, transmission size.
Very good. By way of a comment, I think Alaska, as it kind of exists as one road from Homer to Healy, would be the goal. There's not a big grid there. It's like a wire, right? Is that what we're kind of talking about here?
Well, it's a transmission line, yes, right. One or two, depending on, yes.
Okay, very good. Please continue.
I'll just touch on this very quickly. One idea here is, like I said again, there was a lot of discussion about where planning should take place. And so one of the things that we offered from the Alaska Center for Energy and Power is other small places, like, for example, Hawaii, have moved toward an integrated grid planning approach, which sort of takes into account transmission, generation, and distribution as well. So it's not really just looking at these as individual assets. Now, in Alaska, we've always had, you know, some blending of these, but I do think it's really important to acknowledge that it's difficult to bifurcate planning into generation, transmission, and have those held by different organizations, the lead responsibility for them. So this particular bill lumps all of those under the RTO with expectation for stakeholder involvement, as has been commonplace in other markets like Hawaii. So essentially, you know, going back to those three original goals and how they pertain specifically to SB 257, it really is able to accomplish these three significant goals that is, I think, best practices for a lot of these grid networks that are sort of similar in size to us. This is something that we can do that really moves our system forward. I do believe that there is the need for legislation here. We cannot expect the rail belt utilities, just based on, again, their local entities at heart, to just come together and solve all these issues. There is the need for legislation. Otherwise, we'd be there already, right? So we do need this kind of legislation. I think something like this can do a tremendous amount to move our state forward, move the rail belt forward, make sure that we're maximizing federal funding and getting the cheapest cost power to our constituents wherever they're located along the rail belt grid. So thank you.
Ms. Holdman, thank you very much for your presentation today. Greatly appreciate it. Up next, we have Tony Izzo, CEO of the Matanuska Electric Association, headquartered in Palmer. Mr. Izzo, welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Senator Bjorkman, or Chair Bjorkman. My name is Tony Izzo. I'm the CEO of Matanuska Electric Association, based in Palmer, Alaska. We serve Chugiak, Eagle River, and Palmer, Wasilla, and north. And we serve a growing and the second largest population center in the state of Alaska. I'm going to speak to you today, certainly in support of this bill, but as a co-chair of the Governor's Energy Security Task Force, co-chair of the Rail Belt Subcommittee, the other co-chair was Jen Miller, who's the CEO of Renewable IPP. Ms. Miller and her company have successfully built the Willow and Houston solar farms and are looking to expand in other areas. The way I might approach this, because so much good testimony has already been presented by Senator Giesel and Gwen Holdman, is maybe to give you the perspective of a utility CEO, in addition to being involved with the countless hours that the Energy Task Force put in. I think it was a total of 158 hours for the Rail Belt Energy Subcommittee. I think Alaska, and as an individual who's been in the utility business 43 years, the first 20 in the lower 48, which were regulated by FERC, and since 1999 in Alaska, between NSTAR and Matanuska Electric. I think we would all agree that we are at a crossroads with two issues facing us related to energy. One is an immediate issue. I think of a triage as an example. My father was an Army medic, and so I grew up listening to a lot of medical analogies, and triage was the immediate example that he would use often to teach us various lessons from make sure the patient is breathing before you put that Band-Aid on, kind of a thing. You've got to have your priorities in order. And so in the Rail Belt and the state, I think we have an immediate issue around energy that has to be triaged. And we've heard testimony around Cook Inlet. I experienced the cold snap in which our power plant tripped off. It was just happened to be a coincidence because a sensor went bad and thought there was a gas leak, and it tripped the plant off while the gas pressure in the NSTAR system was declining and SINGSA wells were not performing as predicted. And so I look at the immediate issues, and I think we're working on those. And you've heard lots of discussion around diversifying fuel supply, renewable energy, clean energy, all options on the table, importing LNG, et cetera. Today, what I look at when I see SB 257 is what I think is a critical parallel process. While we're triaging the immediate situation, we should be building a foundation that shifts the paradigm so that we don't find ourselves in this cycle in 10 years again. And I've been in Cook Inlet 24 years, and I've seen us repeat this cycle. This is essentially the third time that I've seen it. The Energy Task Force looked at its work based on the governor's instructions of find us 10 cents a kilowatt hour. Now, my utility roughly is 20 cents a kilowatt hour. If natural gas were free, we could offer power at 12 cents. That's the biggest, the largest component of power is the fuel cost. In terms of the future, though, what we realized is that 10 cents was not feasible right now unless there were unlimited dollars available in order of magnitude in billions of dollars and the resources to and materials to construct those things right now. So what the Rail Belt Task Force did is it shifted its focus to how do we get to that better future? Because we can't find the answer for tomorrow. In fact, we're in a triage situation today and tomorrow. How do we do it in the future? So we came up with three specific goals. Number one goal was unify and upgrade transmission assets, and I'll talk about that. Just for the record, the second goal was diversify generation, meaning don't put all your eggs in one basket. 80% of our fuel supply, 85%, 84% for MEA is natural gas. 16% is mostly hydro, a little bit of solar. One fuel source goes down, we have a major problem. So diversifying generation provides more resiliency and redundancy, and you're less reliable you're less reliable on a single party producing your fuel. And then the third was to increase demand. And you'll find this was put together mostly before the Iceland policy tour, and it was enlightening to go to Iceland and actually see the three recommendations 30 years down the road, where they did exactly unify and upgrade transmission. They did invest. They did diversify generation. They built a lot of extra generation, frankly. And it's all within the state, and then they increased demand through the aluminum smelter process. Our intent, the task force Rail Belt subcommittee's intent was on the transmission goal is to provide a strong transmission system which enables new generation projects to integrate to the grid. Investing in transmission and infrastructure and unifying assets will enable the long-term goal to significantly diversify Rail Belt generation and provide energy that's reliable. When I first arrived in Alaska in 1999, one of the first observations I made, and I hear this often, is, gosh, the electric utilities on the grid, they barely add up to a half of a utility anywhere else. Well, anywhere else, that's true. But anywhere else that I had been were with investor-owned utilities, where you had a lot of shareholder dollars that were willing to invest in infrastructure, in systems. They invested strategically, looking for opportunities to increase shareholder return. Cooperatives are here because investor-owned utilities did not want to invest. They didn't see the opportunity. And what does that all mean? It means that today we have a system that is exactly what our memberships can afford. We don't overbuild things. We don't have a grid that is like the lower 48, where we would be required to have at least two transmission lines. Instead, we have to carry a lot of extra spinning reserve. It's like keeping your car, you know, idle going just in case. And so we have a 30% spinning reserve requirement that we need to have in case something drops off. If we had a second transmission line like the GRIP funding anticipates to start, you can save that fuel. As Ms. Holdman talked about, large-scale renewables. Now you can start to bring in, rather than one utility in its certificated area, looking at, say, a small wind farm where costs are going to come in higher than your existing costs. If you have this electron superhighway from north to south, well, it doesn't matter where that independent power comes on. It doesn't matter whether it's nuclear, mitigated coal. It can be a large wind farm. You can get the economies of scale by which you create economic dispatch for all Alaskans, the 70-75% of Alaskans that live along the rail belt. So what does that mean is that the lowest cost power would come along on first, and it would serve everybody across that region up to the amount that it could provide. Well, demand's going to be higher, so the next increment of the lowest cost comes on, and then the third lowest cost of generation comes on. That's not what happens today. It does in South Central, but because of the constraints north and south, we can't do that. And the GRIP dollars will certainly solve that for us if they're matched, and if we can build that HVDC line, it solves half the equation by double circuiting or creating an electron highway from the Kenai at least to South Central.
I have a question.
Please.
What type of savings would a utility like yours or HEA experience from eliminating part of that spinning reserve that transmission upgrades would allow you to do?
Senator Bjorkman, I don't have a calculation because this is going to be an iterative process in that I want to point to other aspects of the bill. First of all, we're talking about a very low-cost operation being managed by the utilities, like a management committee structure like the Bradley Project. All of the utilities bring their labor in kind, and so I think the O&M budget for Bradley Lake is something like $1.5 million a year for that power plant. It's extremely low, high efficiency. I do have concerns. The ERO came up. I do have concerns that we've heard things projected as high as $10 million a year, which is more than the regulatory commission costs for the entire state. So this organization would be structured very differently. I think a lot of the savings and what we're anticipating this bill needs to do is to separate the transmission in a utility from the backbone, meaning what is the transmission for MEA, for example. We have over 4,800 miles of line. 104 miles is transmission that we believe serves the purpose of moving power north and south. We have other radio lines that are transmission that are above 69 kV that are just radio lines that don't serve to move power north and south. If you were to put those assets together along with the state, and you facilitate the ability to bring in larger scale renewables or clean energy sources, the benefit, the material benefit, is going to come from the lower cost power in the future, lower than it would have been otherwise.
In the interest of time, we are going to have to move on quickly, but is there broad agreement on that number, 104 miles?
From Matanuska Electric, yes, there's 104 miles. That, I don't know offhand what the other utilities' components will be, but I will say that no utility should be financially harmed in this. The task force was very specific that this was not a taking, that revenue requirements had to be met, that no debt covenants were going to be violated, but you would have to split out your backbone from the rest of the transmission. I believe that likely a third-party engineering firm, as Ms. Holdman indicated, is probably best suited to do that, to define what that is. Matanuska Electric will recover its revenue requirement of those 104 miles through the backbone entity, the rest of it through our membership. And when you add them together, we're whole.
We should move on to...
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Rizzo. Appreciate you being here, and I'm sure we'll hear more from you on this topic.
Yep.
Curtis Thayer is online via Teams from the Alaska Energy Authority. That is John Burns. Thank you for the reminder, everyone.
Here you go. Mr. Chairman, John Burns, Golden Valley Electric Association. In the interest of time, I will make my keep my comments very short. I know that we're running out of time here. Let me say that I on behalf of Golden Valley, very supportive of SB 257, and Senator Geisel and the many others who worked on this legislation are to be commended for the comprehensive nature of the proposed legislation. And you heard from Mr. Izzo that the legislation very much aligns specifically with the recommendations of the Alaska Energy Security Task Force, the report that was issued specifically as relates to the priority A of the Railbound Transmission Generation and Storage Subcommittee. And I thought it important to just read some of the benefits that committee noted. By upgrading the transmission, as is indicated through the SB 257, it reduces transmission constraints on the railbound grid while also allowing for the quicker integration of additional clean energy generation, provides system redundancy, resilience, and increases reliability, benefits utilities and ratepayers by sharing power throughout the region, reduces costs for consumers and promotes job creation, and coordinates planning, financing, and construction of new infrastructure, as well as augmenting and diversifying environment, social, and governance investment portfolio holdings. You heard, I think, very well from those who participated before. The objective of SB 257 is to ensure that the lowest cost electron from wherever it is generated, from whatever source, can be transmitted across the rail belt to wherever it is needed, unconstrained at one flat rate. That's the objective. That's the only way that we are going to lower costs across the rail belt. You also heard that this legislation is modeled after what Iceland was able to achieve many years ago. And for those of us who have the privilege of being there and seeing what that sound policy created, what Iceland did was to transform a nation from a nation that was economically challenged and was importing so much of its energy to a nation that is thriving, where businesses are thriving, the landscape is dotted with construction cranes, and the people, the young citizens of Iceland, want to return and are working in Iceland. So instead of having this mass exodus out of the country or out of Alaska as we are having it, Iceland is thriving. Iceland had a vision, and more importantly, they committed to that vision and in doing so transformed hope into reality. And there's no reason that Alaska cannot achieve the same. And so I speak very favorably in favor of 257. And I commend again Senator Geisel for the thoroughness of this legislation. It provides not only the structure, but the funding mechanism, the planning mechanism, the powers and duties of the Rail Belt Transmission Organization. So thank you for allowing me the privilege of presenting today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Burns. Curtis Thayer, you are up next, sir.
All right. Thank you. My name is Curtis Thayer, and I serve as the executive director of the Alaska Energy Authority. I had a slide deck prepared, but I think in the interest of time, a lot of the issues have been covered. But I think it's important to note that many of the transmission lines and associated equipment serving Alaska were constructed over 40 years ago, and in some cases, 50 and 60 years ago. In the intervening decades, demands of Alaska electrical power systems has increased significantly. Indeed, total energy sales from the rail belt has nearly tripled in the last 20 years. Concerns about the future availability of Cook Inlet natural gas has also been raised. It is reasonable to assume growth in total energy sales will continue, and the need for generation using renewables, whether it be hydro, wind, solar, geothermal, will be needed. To support these developments, a robust, resilient, and reliable electrical transmission grid is essential for the future of Alaska. A well-functioning transmission system depends on several basic characteristics: reliability and resilience to reduce and to avoid outages, adequate capacity to meet growing energy demands, flexibility to adapt to changing condition loads and generation resources, and most importantly, overall system cost effectiveness. And I think that's why we're here today and with this bill. And so with that, I would just open myself for any questions you have, and I thank you for the committee's time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Thayer. Are there any questions for any of our presenters today or comments from members of the committee? I would just like to say a couple of things before we close today. I think that as we look at our energy grid and infrastructure systems to move electricity around, it is imperative that customers of electricity get the lowest cost power that they can in order to move our economy forward. It's also imperative that all of our utilities work together to make our utility system better and to empower the gains that we would get from a grid match into a system like this. If the utilities are asking the Alaskan people to allocate hundreds of millions of dollars over the course of the next 10 years for a project that creates redundancy and security from Homer to Healy, I think it's fair for the Alaskan people to also ask for accountability, modernization, and all the utilities to work together. I understand that many would like us to have never-ending natural gas forever and to not do anything. However, I don't know if that's the reality. Certainly not the reality in the short term, and probably not the medium term. But as we look going forward, I think it's clear that something has to be done, and I would like for all utilities to work together on this project and not simply wait, hoping that nothing will happen if we actually do nothing. Because things will happen. And unfortunately, what we saw can happen is that people's houses will be in danger of going cold and their lights will be in danger of going off because we don't have enough fuel. And we don't have enough ability with our grid to move electrons around like we should because we haven't made decisions, sometimes hard decisions, that we need to upgrade. So as we look at what it is that we're doing, I think the time is now to do something. We cannot do nothing. But at the same time, as we're taking action, we need to keep in mind that there are principles in place that we need to be mindful of. That if there are cost causers on the system, that all in all, the people who cause the most cost should pay in a fair way. Open access means that we have open access for cheap generation. And so that those benefits should be available to everyone in the same way. Much as we look at roads and when we're building roads, we don't complain about not being able to use a road when it's under construction. Well, you might complain, it won't do you any good, but you still have to pay for the road while the road's being built. So all of these conversations and more, they need to happen. And I would encourage everyone to participate, because if we expect the Alaska people to pony up the hundreds of millions of dollars that you're asking for in general fund money for transmission, there needs to be accountability in an organization that produces results. And if we have tens of millions of dollars going toward organizations in our state that produce no results, or they advocate for forms of power that are not that reliable, then we might consider their role. That's all I have for today. Senate Labor and Commerce Committee will meet again on Wednesday, March 6th. We'll hear a presentation on TVAP. Hold a second hearing on Senate Bill 121. As there is no further business to come before this committee, we're adjourned at 3:02 p.m.